Good afternoon. This is John Richardson speaking with you from Toronto, Canada. Today is Wednesday, January the 26th, 2020. And today I have a return guest, Mr. LJ Ivan, who is a investment consultant with Raymond James. And as I say, a return guest, because in November, we had a great discussion about U.S. Social Security and how many people living in Canada are likely eligible for that. And ever since, actually, after that podcast with you, I've mentioned that to more and more people who've said, oh my God, I had no idea. So perfect. I gotta tell you, I think you did some good, all right, good. You know, with the November perfect. One. And today, you know, people do live in Canada, and there's an equivalent, the Canada Pension Plan. And that's what we're going to talk about today. So welcome back, LJ. How are you?
Thanks, John, for having me. I'm good. Everybody's healthy. And I guess that's the most important thing right now.
Well, it doesn't really get better than that, I don't think. So that's really good. So, you know, when we talked about this before, you know, the basic theme was that, well, there is U.S. Social Security, and the payouts are actually far more lucrative than I think a lot of people are aware of. But more to the point, it seems to me these government pension plans play a very significant role for a lot of people because they're there, they're indexed to inflation. They may not be perfect, but they're certainly providing a little bit of relief for, you know, people who, you know, for whatever reason, didn't put a lot of attention into financial planning through their lives. So I'm assuming you would agree with that as a general principle.
Yeah. You know, and there's also the survivor benefits. It's the big issue that I find is the surviving spouse is usually the one that is the most dependent on these pension programs. And so, you know, when you're doing the planning, you really want to try to look at the, you know, the whole family making the decision, not just based on your individual situation.
Right. So both U.S. Social Security and Canada Pension Plan do have benefits for surviving spouses. And, you know, in very simple terms, before we even get into what the numbers might be, what's the principle? How does that work?
Yeah, so in Canada, CPP pays you a death benefit, and they also will give you a percentage of the deceased benefits. And, you know, as an example, a surviving spouse, 65, not receiving other CPP benefits, could generally get up to, you know, 60% of the deceased CPP benefits. So it's a lot similar in the U.S. It's based on full retirement age, things like that. But in the U.S., you can get up to 100% of the deceased beneficiary's benefits if you are taking them at full retirement age. So it's a little bit higher in the U.S., but again, there are survivor benefits that, again, play a critical role, especially when it's the higher income earner that passes away first.
Well, certainly anything is better than nothing. So to make it perfectly clear, if one spouse dies, the other does get the benefits, gets a percentage of the benefits the deceased spouse would have gotten. Now, is this for life?
It is for life. And you would always, again, like any of this stuff, it doesn't happen automatically. And so that's where a lot of people get tripped up on these benefits is you do need to apply. They're not just going to come to you and say, hey, you qualify for an additional benefit, even though you're entitled to it.
That's interesting. Yeah. All right. So the first lesson, and I think this is so, so important because, you know, in doing these podcasts, I mean, I've learned a lot because I haven't really thought about this stuff too much. And, you know, I suspect that I'm a good example of people who don't think about this stuff too much. So lesson number one. If your spouse was getting Canada Pension Plan and dies, you're entitled to, what did you say, 60%?
Up to 60% of the deceased benefits, you know, and it's again.
For life.
Yeah.
Now that's kind of interesting because, you know, that leads me to the next question. You know, we talk about family financial planning and that. You know, I read all the time, you know, this debate about, you know, when should people start Canada Pension Plan? I mean, I hear things like 60, I hear 65, I hear 70. But, you know, if we tie that to the spousal benefit, I mean, isn't that an argument for making sure that, you know, the benefits you're receiving are as high as possible when you die?
Yeah, I think that's, like I said, when you're looking at claiming decisions, you know, you should be looking at as a family, not as an individual. And again, it's a pretty big, you know, in a low return environment, again, when you're looking at, you know, whether or not you should take benefits early, the big things that I look at are, hey, how, what's the life expectancy in your family? I mean, are, if you going to be living to 90 or 100, or, you know, do you have that kind of history in your family, then you're going to probably want to delay. The other issue you want to look at is what kinds of rates of return. And typically when you're 65, 70 years old, you're not super aggressive investor anymore. And so your rates of returns are going to be muted. And then those are cases where also you want to try to delay as long as possible to get those, because after 65 in Canada, the pension payment goes up by 8% annualized. And so again, that's almost 40% more benefit payments by waiting 5 years.
That is unbelievable. And yes. So then that would translate into, for a surviving spouse,
yes,
60% of an extra 40% for life, right?
Yeah. And that's where we see a lot of the mistakes. Nobody even thinks about that. You know, again, cancer, illness, all these decisions, you know, again, you think, oh, I should just get my benefits now. And then you end up messing up the surviving spouse for life because you took the benefits early.
So it seems to me that a possible lesson number two here, given that people's circumstances are different, would be, if you do have a spouse, hold off.
And again, you would both hold off if you both expect to live long lives and things like that. So that's the other thing. And so, yeah, it does, again, those are the two things you got to think about. I mean, if you do have life expectancy in your family history, then and you are expecting to get lower rates of returns, then those two things would be decisions to be patient. But again, if those areas are not things that would pop up, then, you know, maybe that would be a decision to get it. But it really is a survivor that gets impacted the most if we don't make these decisions correctly. And like I said, in the United States, it's hundreds of thousands of dollars in benefits on the Social Security side versus, you know, when you take it at 62 versus age 70. And again, it's not just your life, it's also the life of your surviving spouse. So if you have a young spouse, things like that, you know, those benefits could go on for a long time.
Okay. So now you mentioned the U.S. Social Security thing, and I know we discussed this before, but it does seem to me to be a good moment to remind anybody who's listening to this that it is in fact possible for dual citizens in Canada or people who had green cards and are living in Canada to actually be getting benefits from both U.S. Social Security and the Canada Pension Plan. Is that correct?
Yeah. And again, the process is pretty simple. They do make that process simple. It's when you're applying, whether you're applying in the United States or whether you're applying in Canada, all you have to let them know is that you want to have your application reviewed for benefits in both countries. And that's when they work together behind the scenes.
Okay. Now, in these survivor benefits, my understanding is that the Canadian spouse of a U.S. citizen who was died in Canada and received Social Security would be entitled to spousal benefits as well, right?
Yep. There's criteria on, you know, what does work and what doesn't work. And again, those would be things we'd have to look at. But again, the you know, the Social Security Administration's, you know, by the biggest mistake, like I said, a lot of the times is you do qualify, but people just don't take the action to file for the benefits. And that's where we find the biggest mistakes. And the problem is you can only go back so far, maybe 6 months, right? So again, if it's years later that you're filing for benefits, that's money that's just been left on the table.
Okay. So, you know, so that is, I think, extremely important. Now, can I ask you this? You know, we talk about spousal benefits. Let's start with Canada. Who's a spouse anyway? I mean, do you have to be legally married, a common law relationship?
Yeah, I think it's, you know, again, it's probably going to be provincial, and that's, I wasn't prepared for that question, to be honest with you, but it is, it does have the traditional and non-traditional definitions of spouse as part of the CPP program. And, you know, I'm not 100% positive on the.
Okay. But the, yeah, I mean, this stuff can change, of course, but your understanding is, or let me put it another way, based on your understanding, one should not presume that you'd have to have, you know, a legal marriage to qualify. Is that a fair
definitely
statement?
Canada. Yep. Definitely for Canada. And I would confirm that on the US side for you.
Okay. So that's important. So, you know, when people are thinking about this situation, one of the things they need to think about is, so what does it mean to be a spouse? Now, again, I know, you know, we hadn't really planned this podcast out. So, you know, I'm probably, you know, hammering away with odds and ends. They just sort of come into my mind, for which I apologize. But what about duration of a marriage? What if anything, do you know about that? I mean, could somebody get married, you know, the night they're in, you know, getting ready to die, and they think, well, you know, I'd like for this person to have benefits. I think I'll marry them.
Yeah, in U.S., there's definitely a criteria. They need to be at least 1 year married for at least 1 year, at least the age of 62. And again, the big thing on the spousal benefits in the U.S. is the spouse needs to be claiming their benefits already for you to be able to qualify for the spousal benefits. I'm trying to... trying to see here real quick if I made any notes of the criteria. I don't see it in my notes there, John.
Okay, but you know, but that would be a question, obviously, you know, whether there's duration or something. But I mean, this is really interesting stuff. And you know, it, for whatever reason, a lot of it comes as a surprise to me. So, you know, I mean, there's no other way to put it. I mean, there can be clear benefits to, you know, to having a spouse on this whole Canada pension plan stuff or Social Security, right?
Yeah, it's that. And again, it's the, you know, it's just an income stream. And so when we're doing planning, it is, you know, one of the things we just need to know is where are the sources of income. And then everything else has to come from your assets that you've accumulated, you know, throughout that. So that's the real critical part, is just trying to get a good handle on some of the guaranteed incomes, and then looking at what we need to make up on our investment portfolios.
Okay, but this stuff is absolutely guaranteed irrespective of any other assets, which is, I suppose, why it's valuable. Okay, now, so my understanding of the situation in Canada is that this is two separate components, right? Canada Pension Plan and old age security, right?
Correct.
Now, first question I'd like to ask you is this. Do you ever have to have worked or paid into Canada Pension Plan to get the old age security?
The old age security is based on the amount of time you've lived in Canada. It's the CPP that's based on contributions.
Okay. So starting with old age security, I think I saw that you have to have lived for 40 years in Canada or something. Is that correct?
See, the maximum benefit, it's 40 years in Canada.
Okay. So you've lived in Canada for 40 years and you're getting the maximum benefit. Now, this benefit is indexed to inflation, is it?
Yep. Currently, it's $614 a month.
Maximum. Okay. And is it like Canada Pension Plan where if you delay taking it, you get a higher payment?
The it is based on the time that you, when you take it. Yeah, absolutely.
Okay. What is it? I mean, let's say somebody's entitled to a maximum on that. If they were receiving it today, what would they get?
Yeah, right now I'm showing the 2022 numbers, $614 a month.
Okay, so 614. So, you know, I'd rather have that than not, obviously, but it doesn't seem like it's enough to live on, clearly, right?
Yep.
Okay. And now a married couple or everybody 65 or older in a household would get that separately and independently, right?
That's correct.
Okay. All right. Now, so that is not based on contributions or anything. Okay, that's just based on time in Canada. Now, moving over to the Canada Pension Plan, which I understand is based on contributions,
right,
over a career.
Right.
Can you explain in the general sense how that works?
Yeah, so like the US, it uses three criteria. It's basically how much you contribute, so how much you make and how much your contributions to the CPP plan, how many years you contributed to plan. That's another factor in the US. Like I said, it's the 35 highest earnings year. And so Canada uses another formula. They don't give you a number, they just how many years. And then the age you start to decide. So again, when you are making decisions, you get penalized for taking the money at 60, and you get a benefit for waiting until age 70. So again, those are the three criteria they use when they're coming up with your primary insurance amount, CPP payment.
Okay, so it sounds like there's two broad issues. Okay. The amount that you're entitled to, whether it's maximum, less than maximum, or whatever, the base amount you're entitled to at any point in time is based on contributions, correct?
Correct, on the CPP side.
But once the sort of basis, okay, or, you know, are you maximum or minimum or whatever has been decided, the later you wait, the higher the payment to you. Is that correct?
That's right. So after 65, you start to get a 0.7% per month increase in the benefit, you know, times that by 60 months. That's where you come up with the 40% in additional benefits, about 8.4% per year in additional benefits after 65.
Okay. All right. So let's assume for the moment a maximum payout. Could you help us with what would it be at age 60 if you started age 65 and age 70?
Yeah, right now I just have the number of 65, so it'd be 1253. But then you would just take that 1253 and you would subtract 7.2% for every year you took it earlier.
Oh, it's about 35% less, yep. And you'd add about 40% if you waited till 70.
40, actually, 42 is the actual number when you get to.
That's interesting. I mean that is clearly a substantial difference. And then when you factor in the spousal benefit, that seems to me to be significant.
Yeah, and I think the things that we do is obviously everybody's scenario is different, right? And some people just don't have the extra cash to be able to wait this stuff out. So that's where the planning and the and these calculators that we use to do this, we can, help you make that decision. But at some point in time, some people, need it earlier versus later. But the decision seems to be, if you have other assets and you can delay these decisions, that seems to be the best scenario for the entire family.
I just had a thought on that if you, leaving aside, Social Security or Canada Pension Plan, if you do a reasonable job in the rest of your financial planning, it really allows you to compound the benefits from Canada Pension Plan, doesn't it?
Yeah, no, that's what I'm saying. So, it's hard to get an 8% rate of return when you're
very hard
in a conservative asset allocation. And so for me, that's where a lot of people just maybe haven't heard those statistics or maybe don't know that about it, or, maybe nobody's given them that information, but that's really the return you're giving up by taking the benefits early. And so it's something that, should be reviewed. And again, like I said, if the plan says it's not on track and you have to take it earlier, then that's when we would take it earlier. But again, looking at it, the big picture, looking at all your income sources, looking at your assets, again, the ideal way to maximize your benefit is to try to wait till age 70. And it's funny, it's about, less than 5% in the US to take it at age 70. And it's the same in Canada. Everybody sort of takes it as soon as they can.
So help me with that, okay? I have over the years, read these articles where I can see people are sort of, you know, making the case for taking it early or not. And I've never, I mean, I'm not an actuary, so I've never really understood this. Although what I think I do understand, and I'd be interested if you could would confirm or disconfirm, is if you're thinking on living a relatively long life, you better wait and delay this stuff. Would that be right?
Yeah, I think that's the you know the one of the two criteria, right? What kind of return are you going to get on your money? So how are you invested? Are you super conservative? Well, then you're probably going to get closer to 3 to 5, something in that area. And the second thing is just if you expect to live, you know, past 80, you know, then it usually, at least in the U.S., that's the break-even age. So 80 is the break-even age. If you wait till age 70 to take your benefits, and once you pass 80, then you're in the green. And so that's where, you know, I have more statistics around this. This stuff is on the Social Security side. But again, it's very similar to the Canadian side. There's break-even ages where if you waited till, you know, 66 to take your benefits versus 60, you know, your break-even would be, you know, and in the U.S., like I said, it's 75, 78, and 80. Those are the years. And 75 is when, if you took it at 62, you know, at age 75 is when you would pass that break-even number for taking it at age 66, et cetera. So those are the kinds of things you'd have to look into. But if you're past age 80, you know, that's, you know, typically the decision that you should wait as long as you can.
Well, I mean, people are clearly living longer. And as you were describing that, I read in the Washington Post today that Nancy Pelosi at age 81 has decided that she wants to make another run for Congress.
Well, it's the average age, just statistically, in 2017 was 79.7, and in 2060 we expect it to be 85.6. And so again, not huge difference, but definitely more towards the, you know, mid 80s to 90 is.
So you're telling me that the average life expectancy is now mid 80s?
Yeah.
That's incredible.
Yeah.
I mean, there's no way these programs could have been designed, I think, you know, with that in mind, right?
No, and that's where, you know, they have to adjust the amount that they tax you on as far as your income base. That's where they change the percentages on the CPP withholdings to sort of make these programs, whole. And that's, like I said, why the U.S. system, even if the trust fund does go bankrupt, you know, 80% of the benefits currently are paid by payroll tax. And so what they do is they just adjust the income levels. Or they just
print more money.
Or they print more money, or they tell you your full retirement age is now 67, or, you know, they change those kinds of things.
They seem to be moving that up. Okay. My recollection is that in Canada, there's some.
That's how they make the formulas work, right? They're not going to cut the benefits, right? Nancy Pelosi's not going to give.
I don't see how they can cut the benefits.
You can't cut the benefits.
There's too many people without any money. That's the problem.
Right. So those are the ways to do it.
You know, do I see all these arguments for let's take it now? Let's take it at age 65. I mean, what are they thinking or not thinking?
I just think they think, I think really what they think when the U.S., like I said, they think the systems are going broke. You know, nobody's really sat down and kind of talked about the planning with them or spent a lot of time thinking about that. You know, for me, like I said, it's just, you know, pretty common to talk about Social Security in the United States, but in Canada, you know, again, you don't hear a lot of people talking about it. So that's, again, just sort of the people I like working with and kind of understanding some of these issues. But it just seems to me that it is a bigger piece of people's retirement income plan than they had originally thought. And again, it just seems silly to me if, you have other assets that you can draw on while you're letting these assets accrue, that it's, the best return on your money.
Well, I think the problem is that, you know, it seems to me in my sort of simple-minded way that, you know, if you knew you were going to die in your 70s, you know, then that may be a good argument to take this stuff, right? But the problem is if you don't, you know, then you've actually got a bigger problem than dying, right? And that's to figure out how to pay for your life, right?
Right.
Very interesting.
Yeah. So like I said, I think those are the key numbers for us, you know, that we look at is, you know, 75, 78, and 80. And like I said, if 80 is something that, you know, you believe you can get to, then you should be delaying as long as you can.
Mm-hmm. All right. That's all really good stuff. Now in Canada, are there, I know with U.S. Social Security, children get certain benefits from this in certain circumstances, I think, right? Is that also the case for something like Canada Pension Plan, or is it limited to spouses?
Yeah, you know, I don't see anything on the children. You're right, on the U.S. side, you know, if the parents retire and the kid's still young, they get Social Security payments up to 18, things like that. I don't see anything similar in Canada's side around the children.
Okay. So, you know, let's say we put this in practical terms for the moment. Imagine that we're dealing with just a, you know, a Canadian without any entitlement to U.S. Social Security. What I think I'm understanding from you is that if that person were getting maximum benefits under Canada Pension Plan, let's say age 65, and under old age security, it sounds to me as though it'd be about 614 plus 1200, what did you say, 85?
About 1253.
Plus 1253, so that's about $1,870 per month?
Right.
And that's taxable, correct?
The way the it's taxable. It is taxable. Yes.
It's included in taxable income.
Yeah. Yeah. Exactly.
Okay. All right. But I mean, that's not. Well, first of all, it's very difficult to imagine that anybody could actually live off that. Unless it were a married couple and they were each getting the same, right?
Yeah, it's the benefits are definitely not as attractive as they are in the United States.
Yeah. So, I mean, this is, of course, you know, one reason why, you know, the type of stuff you do, why financial planning is absolutely essential.
Yeah. And I, you know, again, it's just, you know, things are going to change. So, you know, it's not just doing the plan once either, John, it's really having it as sort of a living document and being able to update it annually. You know, 28% returns in the markets last year obviously changed people's financial plans, you know, down 10% year to date, things like that. That's changing people's financial plans. So it's just something that, again, we want to make sure we're reviewing it on a regular basis, not just one time, put it in the, you know, drawer and forget about it. It's really sort of using it as a living document to stay on top of it as you kind of make these decisions.
Yeah. So, I mean, I guess you're saying, and I think I would agree with this, the financial planning is not a one-off. It's a work in progress.
Yeah. Yeah. You fall off a ladder or you do something, you can't travel anymore. Obviously, those are going to change the, you know, your you know, wishes and expectations and things like that. So, you know, that's a big part of our process is just continuing to come back to a living document.
Let me ask you this. My impression is that a very significant percentage of humanity doesn't think about this stuff at all. Or if they do, it's far too late. Am I correct?
It ranges. But I do find that, just based on the numbers of people that file early, you know, or not even at full retirement age, it makes me realize that either there is very poor, you know, balance sheets out there, or, you know, people just aren't educated on, you know, all the nuances of the programs. They are complex, right? There's lots of bells and whistles. But again, I think, you know, just a little bit of education around it, you know, can help really sort of help you navigate kind of these benefit programs. And again, you know, not leave all that money on the table if, you know, if you have assets elsewhere that you can draw.
Right, right. Very interesting. Well, as we come to an end here, let me just ask you generally, I mean, you know, we've talked twice about, you know, two very specific aspects of financial planning, the Social Security in the U.S. and Canada Pension Plan in Canada, and actually how they interact, I think, you know, last time, and some people might be entitled to both. I mean, do you have a general philosophy of investing that you'd be willing to share I mean, what, how do you think people should think about investing in financial planning?
You know, I mean, I think, you know, I always, you know, if there's a way we can take the less, least amount of risk to get the highest rate of return, you know, that's always the way that we like to do it. And typically with a financial plan, it's around setting some expectations and then going back and seeing based on your assets you saved, whether that's realistic, and then coming back to you and saying, okay, well, those plans are not realistic. So there's only so many things we can do. We can take more risk. We can work longer. We can live on less, things like that. But those are the conversations where we'd start. But typically the ideal portfolio is one that allows you to sleep at night and still achieve your financial goals. And so I always try to take the least amount of risk to get to that point. And then, like I said, I think some people, you know, again, we have to take more risks because they just,
well, if they leave it till later, I guess they do. Right. So, I mean, yeah. I guess one message I think I'm hearing from you is start early, right?
It's always, you know, compounding is a big deal, right? So, you know, always starting earlier has the biggest impact for sure. And then just keeping it in front of you, you know, just sort of setting the resetting the goals and expectations on a regular basis, so that you stay focused on kind of the kind of how to get in the dunk column, kind of like anything else, you know, a football plan or a, you know, a financial plan or anything, you gotta, you know, just kind of execute it. But you need to spend some time, you know, drafting it up in order for it to work.
So last time we talked, I don't know if you quite put it this way, but maybe I can put it this way. I think you more or less brought Raymond James to Canada, didn't you?
Merrill Lynch asked my parents to move their account, IRA accounts. And Raymond James was looking for a CEO to set up a cross-border platform. And so I left Merrill Lynch to try to solve problems for people that had money on both sides of the border. And so, yes, I created Raymond James USA. It was there already. They were already doing some more on the institutional side. But on the private client side, more on the individual side, that's where Raymond James took kind of a leadership role in Canada. And, you know, we got about 145 advisors now across Canada and 50 plus branches that do cross-border solutions. And so
so your license basically, for example, to hold US IRAs and this sort of stuff, right?
Yeah, so we're licensed in both countries. We operate basically like an outside business activity. We're registered with Raymond James in Canada, and we're registered through Raymond James USA, which is a FINRA organization. But that's how we do it. It's two, we work for two firms, but it's the single person that's sort of managing the assets on both sides.
But for dual citizens or people with dual tax residency, you'd be a one-stop shop, right?
Yeah. And it's really then surrounding ourselves also with the other professionals, right? That's where this all has to kind of be in coordination. You have to have the CPA and the attorney and the estate plan and the investment guy on the same page, right? So that, you know, again, it's all coordinated.
Very, very interesting. All right. Well, listen, I really appreciate part two of our discussion here. And I think it'd be great to have a part three and a part four, whatever, but this is really good stuff. And perhaps in closing, how would people get in touch with you?
Yeah, you know, the best way to get a hold of me is, you know, lj.ibin@raymondjames.ca. And, you know, my email is, you know, like I said, the most efficient right now with, still kind of working remotely and things like that.
All right. Well, that is great. Really appreciate your taking the time to lay this stuff out today, and look forward to our next discussion.
Awesome. Thanks, John.